Yeah, it's specifically Purim. It's not that you can't make your own Pesach or anything, except for Pesach Sheni. And that is, it's brought down in many, many people. If they had a miracle that happened to their family or to their city, sometimes it was city-wide, sometimes it was family-wide, they would celebrate an annual Purim, and they would have a Suda, and, you know, again, it doesn't really change that much, but it's a Sudas Mitzvah, and it would be a permanent minug of their family. Quite a few. For example, I remember in 1977 or something, the Hanafi Muslims, which was a precursor of Al-Qaeda, took the B'nai B'rith building in D.C., and it took hostages, Jewish hostages. And when the Baruch Hashem, miraculously, everybody was spared, so the family of the rabbis, who have since was Nifter, made an annual Purim Suda to honor that. So that's an old minhag. The Pesach Yom Kippur records it. And the like, but usually it would only be something that's somewhat miraculous, somewhat unusual. You wouldn't, you know, a routine thing. You wouldn't do that. So that's called the family Purim. So that's what's in.
Why do you say that Jews, for example, those who perished in the Holocaust, died al kiddush Hashem? It seems like if someone is dying in deliberate effort to make Hashem beloved, or something like that, and that's kiddush Hashem. But if someone is trying to hide the fact that they're Jewish, or they just happen to get murdered, just because they're Jewish, why does that make it a kiddush Hashem?
Right, that is a very good question. Normally, the meaning of kiddush Hashem is that I'm given a choice to renounce my Judaism or to die. And if it's the Gimel Chamuras, Avodah Zarah, Gilui Shrichas Damim, where I'm supposed to give up my life, if I give up my life rather than violate the Torah, I am sanctifying God's name because I am showing that God's will is more important to me than my very life. Right? That's the normal meaning of Kiddush Hashem. So based on that, your argument is that in the Holocaust, Jews didn't have a choice, even if you were willing to convert. In fact, there were Jews who converted to Christianity. In fact, there's a woman that's canonized. She was a nun, Edith Stein, who was made a saint by the Catholic Church because she died in Auschwitz as a martyr to her faith, which is very peculiar because she didn't die because she was Catholic. She died because she was Jewish. So the question becomes, how could you describe that as a Kiddush Hashem when there was no choice? Number one, some Jews converted and it didn't help. And some Jews, many Jews, tried to hide their identity and that didn't help. And even the religious Jews were not killed because they were religious. They were killed because they're Jewish. So can that be called Al Kiddush Hashem? So the MS is, it's a very good question. It certainly does not fit the classical Talmudic definition of Kiddush Hashem. But there is a tshuva from the Rambam. Now the Rambam was writing about Islamic persecutions that were killing Jews at various times in the 11th century. And the Rambam writes, when anyone is killed because they are Jewish, not because they're religious, if they are killed because they are Jewish, as opposed to a random murder victim, the Rambam says that alone is called a Kiddush Hashem. Now the question is why. He doesn't fully explain how that makes a Kiddush Hashem. But it goes back to the idea that the hatred of Amalek, or a nation like Amalek, for the Jewish people is ultimately a war against God. Meaning Hitler hated the Jews because he saw in the Jewish people the army of God. And therefore he really was rebelling against God. That's what the Torah says. Amalek is fighting against Hashem. And Hitler wanted to destroy God from the world. Because again, if you read it, because Mein Kampf really spelled everything out. Hitler saw religion and saw belief in God as something that limited the power of man. It told man, you can't do certain things. And he did not want the power of the human being to be limited. So essentially, therefore, if you are killed because you're Jewish, you are killed because you represent the nation of God. And therefore, in a sense, therefore, you died in the service of your Creator, even if you didn't consciously think that. But if you're being killed because you're in God's army, that is considered to be dying in the service of God, which is Kiddush Hashem. It's an unusual way of looking at it, but that seems to be what the Rambam says. As opposed to someone who just gets run over, you know, someone who gets killed with no direct connection to his being Jewish, that would not be Al Kiddush Hashem.
Why was the snake punished when, if he was an angel, then he doesn't have free will and he had to do what God told him to do?
Right.
Or if he was just an animal, it doesn't have free will to begin with, so it's just doing what he does.
Well, okay, in other words, if we assume the second position, that he was a creature, then I think we would have to assume, obviously, since he walked and talked and everything else, we would have to assume that at that point in time he did have free will, because, which is, again, very difficult, because the implication is that man is unique. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're going to tell me man is unique, well, it's man and the snake are unique. You know, yeah. It's going to be difficult. But again, the same way the snake talked, it could be posited he had free will for that purpose. But more basically, you are right. We describe the snake as the Yetzer Hara, the power of evil, which through the eating of the Eitz Hadas became internalized in man, but prior to that point was an external force. And in a sense, the Yetzer Hara got to do what it does. I mean, that's its job. And it is not rebelling against God, in a sense, because the Yetzer Hara's job is to try to make me sin. I mean, that's what the Yetzer Hara's job is. The Yetzer Hara's job is to cause me to sin. So it wouldn't make sense for God to punish the Yetzer Hara, because the Yetzer Hara is doing what it's supposed to do. So I think that's a very, very excellent question. It seems to be the following, that the idea of the so-called punishment of the snake is not so much a punishment as it is a necessary lesson to mankind that evil is ultimately something that is bad and doesn't have its redemption. In other words, you could almost say, in a sense, the snake had to suffer. That was part of its mission, as a message to mankind, that mankind should be perpetually reminded that evil is an ugly, debased thing and should not look at it as something that's glorified. So I would look at it more as a consequence, right? God gives jobs to these different forces, and the job of this embodiment of evil was to show its ugliness, to kind of take away some of the attraction. Even now, it has plenty of attraction, but it takes away some of the luster, some of the attraction. But it's a very good question. Yeah?
In the Gemara in Tanis on Tes Amud Beis, it talks, there's a machlokes between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua, exactly about how clouds are formed. And the Maharsha on that particular piece says it's a machlokes of the scientists and the philosophers. So does that mean, now that we know that it's no longer a machlokes, that we can say that one is wrong and one is right?
Well, you know, that's a difficult issue. You have a lot of issues like that. You have scientific discussions in the Gemara, thank you, where either it doesn't fit our science or whatever. Let me just give you a general comment of the Maharal. Now, the Maharal was around the same time as the Marsha. And the Maharal discusses it in a different context, but it would apply here as well. The Maharal discusses a Gemara in Sukkah that perhaps you guys saw, about why there are eclipses. Now, why does the sun get covered up? The eclipse. So it'll say, you know, because of a nasi that commits an aveira, or somebody who commits adultery with a betrothed woman. And people ask the question, well, what do you mean, why are there eclipses because of sins? We know why there are eclipses. This is the rotation of the earth and the sun and everything else, and eventually they come together. And we can predict eclipses thousands of years in the future based on recurring patterns. How can you imply that an eclipse happened because somebody sinned, you know, in Cleveland one night or whatever, that causes an eclipse? So the people who are skeptical, the people who don't believe in Chazal, say that Chazal were superstitious. They didn't know what eclipses were, and therefore they had to connect it to sin, but we have more sophistication. We have science. So the Maharal, who wrote a very important sefer, it's even been translated in English. It's called the Be'er HaGola. And the Be'er HaGola is the Maharal's defense of Torah Shebal Peh against attacks by Christians and others. And the Maharal says, Chazal certainly understood science. And they understood, for example, that the scientific cause of an eclipse is connected to the coordinations of the revolution of the earth around the sun and the sun's revolution within the galaxy, etc. And when they come together, you're going to have these different things. But Chazal are looking at things in terms of their spiritual causes, because here's the idea. God could have made the world in infinite ways. God could have made a world where gravity goes up instead of down, right? So granted, within the natural laws that God chose, you're going to have eclipses. But why did God choose to create a universe where eclipses will happen? God could have made the universe in another way. And the answer is, because God coordinates, and this is pretty miraculous, since God knows the future, God coordinates this is really, it's not even explainable in human terms, but God coordinates the natural cycles to kind of correspond to when so-and-so is doing Averis in Cleveland. So it's not that when Reuven does an Avera, God makes an eclipse. But rather the recurring cycles of nature that God built into Sheshet Yemei Bereishis are corresponding to the various times when Averis are going to be done. And therefore the Maral says, it's not that Chazal were ignorant of natural causes, but Chazal are looking at the spiritual cause for the natural cause. And the proof that he brings is from the phenomenon of the Torah itself. The Torah says, what is a rainbow? In Parshas Noach, it tells me a rainbow is a sign from God that he is not going to destroy the world, at least by water. Right? That's the rainbow. The rainbow represents like a bow that is upside down, as if to say, I'm not going to shoot this world down. So the Maral says, well, what does that mean? We know what a rainbow is. A rainbow is when there are water vapor or water drops in the air, and the white light hits the water drops, and the water drops operate as a prism, breaking the white light into colors, right? We know that. We know that's why there is a rainbow. So how could the Torah itself describe the rainbow as some sign from God? The answer is that, yes, the physical reason is water or light hits the water. But why did God make a world where white light diffracts or refracts when it hits the water? The answer is to communicate that spiritual truth. So that would mean the following. When you learn Gemaras that purport to give scientific explanations, the Maral says they are usually not scientific explanations. They usually have deeper spiritual meanings. And if Chazal used a vocabulary of science sounding like a scientific explanation, it is really symbolic of a spiritual meaning. Now, if you're asking me what the spiritual meaning is, the best I can tell you is, look at the Maral's comment on that Agadah, and you'll kind of get a sense of what's going on. But that's what he says. Now, I want to mention that the Maral's idea of spiritualizing any scientific explanations in the Talmud is not universally accepted. Many Rishonim understood that the Gemara was giving a scientific explanation, and they then concluded it's entirely possible in the realm of science Chazal were not always accurate. And therefore, the Rambam and the Rambam's son, who is a great gadol, do take the position that in matters of science, it is possible that Chazal were expressing the best science of the time, but it may not be accurate. The Maral rejected that notion by basically saying, not that Chazal's science was right, but rather Chazal were not intending to communicate scientific truth, they were intending to communicate spiritual truth. So there's a machlokas, how to learn those agadas. But the Maral does have four volumes called Chidushei Agadas, so you can look in Maseches Tanis, and you can actually see an explanation that he'll give for that type of Gemara.
So, off of that, with the rainbows, does that mean before Noah that light didn't refract through prisms and separate into its individual colors?
You know, that is a possible understanding, but I think what the Maral is saying is that even if rainbows existed from the very beginning of creation, since God knew there would be a flood and we would need the sign, he set up the physical universe ahead of time to give us that sense of reassurance, right? That's how the Maral would learn it.
Building off that question again, now that we know when a lunar eclipse or when any eclipse is going to happen, so does that mean we know when people are going to sin? People are going to sin on this day at, 1 a.m.
Yes. I think that means we do know. However, we don't know who, and each person has free will. So it goes back to the idea, as the Rambam says in Hilchos Tshuva, even though God decreed that the Jewish people will be enslaved, but God never decreed who will be the person enslaving them. So the enslaver has free will. Now, the question is the obvious mystery. If every potential sinner in the world has free will not to sin, and if they would have exercised their free will not to sin, would that mean the eclipse would be canceled? Once again, it's kind of the mystery of God knows, who's going to make the choice, and therefore there's an eclipse. But theoretically, at least, that would enable the concept of canceling. So if we have a mass tshuva rally next to the eclipse, maybe we can stop it somehow. Who knows? Yeah.
Why don't we apply Sfeika Dayoma to Mitzvos Derabanan, particularly
Now Now you're thinking, let's say, whether like Hanukkah, in other words, I'm guessing Purim, you know, for Shush and Purim, but in terms of Purim outside of Yerushalayim, yeah. So here's the thing. Let me take Omer separately, because Omer is really a separate question. You are correct that when a Yom Tov is only rabbinic, we do not have a double day in Chutz La'aretz. We don't have 9 days of Hanukkah. We don't have 2 days of Purim in Chutz La'aretz and the like. And the question is, why don't you follow the principle of calendrical doubt? So the short answer is, it could very well be, when at a time when there was genuine uncertainty, when they used to sanctify Rosh Chodesh by witnesses, and the reason we kept 2 days in the diaspora is because we didn't know when, we really didn't know when Rosh Chodesh was, it could very well be they kept 2 days. But today, and by today I don't mean just today, I mean from the time that they went from witnesses to a fixed calendar, in reality there is no doubt anymore because we know through the calendar when Rosh Chodesh is. But the Gemara in Be'ah still says we have to keep 2 days because once it was a minhag that was established, the Chachamim wanted us to keep those 2 days. But since intrinsically there is no longer a doubt, it is simply a rabbinic enactment. It is not because of a genuine doubt. So just like we say the rabbis don't make a gezerah on top of a gezerah, so they're not going to make a rabbinic law to keep two rabbinic holidays and the like. Now that is why, so what I'm suggesting is there may have been a historical change, meaning to say there may have been a time in which they kept 9 days of Hanukkah and 2 days of Purim when there was real doubt, but when it switched over to a takanas chachamim, even though there's no doubt, so then we go back to 1 day. Okay? Now, Yom Kippur, just as an aside, you might ask Akasha, though, logically, why don't we have 2 days of Yom Kippur in Chutz La'aretz? Because that would make a lot of sense. The short answer is yes, indeed, it would make sense. But the Chachamim didn't impose that for a totally different reason, that fasting 2 days in a row would have been too difficult for people. Perhaps it even would have created Sakana, so they didn't want to make it Sakana. So we have 2 days of Rosh Hashanah, and that's even here. We have 2 days of Sukkot, but only 1 day of Yom Kippur. Now, vis-a-vis the counting of the Omer, you're also correct that logically there could have been a Sfiras HaOmer, a double up here, because if the second night of Pesach is the first night, then the second day of Sfira should be 1-2, the third day of Sfira should be 2-3, etc., and the like. So, according to most opinions, that Sfira is Drabanan. That would be your answer, right? The only question is that the Rambam's view is that Sfira Sa'omer is a Torah requirement, even today, because the counting of the Omer does not depend on the sacrifice of the Omer. So the question is, according to the Rambam, why do we not count a double Sfira Sa'omer? So here is the answer the Baal HaMor gives. The Baal HaMor in Arvei Pesachim says the following idea. Even when there was a real suffix, it was only a minority chashash, because intrinsically, most of the years, we knew that the first day was the real day. So consequently, like this, if the first day is the real day, so 1 second, what is this cheshvan? So you start counting the second day. So the second day, you'd only count day one, because that's the most it could be. The third day, you would count, 1 second, the third day, you would count day one and two. Right, the third day of Pesach would be day one and two. So 1 second. So if you would count on the third day, day one, this Teretz is not computing. I think the cheshbon he makes is, you would be implying that the second day was Yom Tov, and that would be a zilzal to the first day. But that doesn't make sense, because every time you have a second day of Yom Tov, you're creating. Okay, I'm going to have to check that. But at least lahalacha, the answer is a good answer, because lahalacha, sfira is drabanan. But I'll check if it's d'oraisa, why don't we do that? I'll be mine, if that's a good question. Yeah.
I've heard that according to the Ramban, that Pesach was considered the beginning of Yom Tov, Shavuos was considered the second half of Yom Tov, and Sfiras HaOmer would be like the Chol HaMoed.
Right.
So are there those that would hold that you shouldn't say Tachna throughout all Sfiras HaOmer?
No. There is such a minhag that is recorded in early Rishonim, but there's no. I don't believe there's any present minhag that does it. Now, of course, among Hasidim, they often don't say Tachanun on the yard side of a Rebbe, and there are so many Rebbes that they often don't say Tachanun, but we don't really follow that way. In fact, I've even heard the suggestion. This is very intriguing. We all know, of course, during Sfira, we don't get haircuts and we don't make weddings. So most the reason that's normally given is to commemorate the mourning of the students of Rabbi Akiva that died. But some want to suggest that the original reason was that these are the laws that are connected to Chol HaMoed. Chol HaMoed, you don't do haircuts and you don't make weddings. And as a result, the origin was not mourning and sadness. The origin was the Chol HaMoed observances, which is very, very interesting. Of course, that wouldn't explain the 33 days. If you take the paradigm of Chol HaMoed, you wouldn't be allowed to do it for 49 days. But nevertheless, there is such a swara that might have been the original reason. But Tachanun we do say. Yeah.
Is there not a constellation in the Jewish calendar? By the way, I don't even know what that means. Under which it is said, these people will draw blood. And doesn't that mean that a full 1/12 of the male Jewish population should be some sort of blood drawer, such as a moel, surgeon, shochet, murderer, vet, etc.? But we don't see this to be the case.
Yeah, yeah. The idea of constellations are really zodiac signs. Now, again, rabbinic astrology does not correspond totally to astrology out there. But this is a controversial area. This is what a mazel is. You know, we say mazel, have good luck. You know, mazel, mazolos, are really the particular configurations of planets and stars under which a person is born based on the zodiac, and that's both based on the month and the day of the month and the time of day. Time of day is actually very critical in this as well. The mazel madim, which is Mars, that really depends on the time of day. Meaning to say, it's not necessarily anyone that's born on a certain day of the year. It's anyone that's born at a certain time and day of the week. So I don't know if you're going to get 1/12, meaning because you really have a much larger system to work with here. But be it as it may, there is a Gemara that says, he who is born under the red constellation, which is Mars. What's the sign of the zodiac? What's Mars? It's called, I don't remember, is it called Mars? Whatever it is, will be a lover of blood and can decide to be a shochet, a moel, or a murderer. You'll have blood lust. Now, this itself is a controversial issue because on one hand we say, well, what about free will? Can't every person choose to be a tzaddik? And there's another Gemara that says, Ein mazel Yisrael, Jewish people are not governed by mazel. They have a direct relationship with that. But the simple meaning of the text is that the Gemara is really addressing a very fundamental issue, and that is you're born with certain tendencies, meaning free will is not as absolute as we think. Today, we wouldn't talk about mazel, we would talk about DNA, but it's the same thing. In other words, the DNA is the part of your personality that is predetermined. And people are raising the question, if so much of your personality is predetermined, how do you have free will? And the short answer is, free will doesn't mean you change your personality, but it means you channel your personality to do good. Right? So somebody might be quiet or whatever it is, quiet or energetic. Their goal in life is not to take their energetic personality and become quiet, or to take their quietness and become energetic, but it's rather to take who they are and channel it in a good way. So the Gemara is making the very marvelous point that yes, you're going to love blood, but you can channel it in good ways, and that's where Bechira comes in. So Bechira doesn't mean everybody starts like an empty, you know, tabula rasa, and then chooses, but rather they're given different frameworks. And they make Bechira within those frameworks, right? That's why it's not a contradiction. Now, the question that you asked is, if statistically a pretty large portion of people are going to be born under the mazel of Mars, and they're going to have bloodlust, and if they don't direct it in good ways, they're going to do it in bad ways, so what do we do about that? Are there all these axe murderers kind of lurking in the Jewish community. No, I think I've met some of them. Now, but the short answer is that, once again, bloodlust can express itself in a lot of ways. What about those ambitious businessmen or those killer lawyers, right? So it could be, once again, that the idea of blood, which is the notion of, you know, vanquishing, defeating, destroying, can have many, many applications, maybe besides the ones that the Gemara enumerates. And perhaps, you know, who knows, perhaps the old anti-Semitic accusation of Jews being, you know, sharp businessmen, you know, maybe that's connected to a certain amount of the population of the Mars people that didn't get into the Shechitah business and the like. So all I'm saying is that the Gemara does not mean to be exhaustive. The Gemara doesn't mean to say those are the only occupations these people might find themselves in. But I think when you deal with, you know, ambition and kind of a certain aggressiveness or an aggression towards your foe, that might be a reflection of that bloodlust. So that you unfortunately do have. In other
areas. What is the time of day that is marked?
Yeah, the time of day, I believe, is the sixth hour of the day, between 6 and 7, but not every day. It's a cycle. So I know, but I'll tell you a story. Between 6 and 7 on Friday, for sure, is that mazel. But then it recurs according to the number of hours in the week based on a regular cycle. The reason I know this, and by the way, 6 and 7 are not necessarily clock hours because they're measured from true noon. Again, because of time zones, you understand that when it's 12 o'clock in Jerusalem or 12 o'clock in New York, it actually is not true noon because it's only true noon is when the sun is at its highest point in the sky. Now, because of time zones, basically, there's only one place where 12 o'clock is true noon. That's the middle of the time zone. So technically, the middle of the time zone for Jerusalem is Cairo. So really, we're living on Cairo time, technically. In other words, in Cairo, when it's 12 noon, the sun is at the highest point in the sky. In Jerusalem, that would be like 11:40 or something like that. So when I say 12, so when you count 6 hours from noon, it's 6 hours from true noon. Right? So you have to adjust that because time zones mean that there is no such thing as accurate time, because the accurate meaning of noon is the sun at its highest point in the sky, and that will depend on every individual location. But be it as it may, the reason I know that this was important is when I lived in Boston, so I used to spend many Shabbos with the Boston Rebbe. This is the father of the present Boston Rebbe, you know, also lived in Har Nof the last years of his life, and there were many, many people. Typically, we'd have like 100 people for Shabbos, just very, very, very good. But the Rebbe had this thing, he would not make Kiddush Friday night between 6 and 7, because this is the mazel of Mars, and it's considered to be a bad mazel, and you don't want to say brachas at a time when there's a midas hadin in the world. It might bring in din. So it always took a long time to get seated. I still remember these mad rushes. Like if we finished davening a 5:45, people had this mad rush to get the kiddush right away because once it hit 6, we're going to have to wait an hour. And you know, sometimes you made it, sometimes you didn't. I mean, I remember a number of times. You know, 6:01, sorry, you know, no kiddush until 7, and the like. So he was very, very mocked not to make kiddush during that particular hour.
I
was downtown that day, and I actually went, I had to go into a store for something, and there was actually a television, and I see the Pope sandwiched in between the two chief rabbis, and I'm not sure. I think the Pope's crucifix was probably out because he had his hand there, but he had his hand covering it. Did he tuck it in? Okay, so I was wondering why he kept it. Maybe because he kept his hand. I was wondering. I wasn't sure. You know, as popes go, this guy is actually pretty good. You know, he seems to be a very compassionate, caring person. But I saw that Rav Yitzchak Yosef, Rav Avad Yosef's son, who is the Sephardic chief rabbi, was wearing something gold around his neck. I couldn't figure out what it was. It actually was the Aseret HaDibros. He was wearing the Ten Commandments around his neck. Yeah, so kind of Pope has his thing, I have my thing, etc. But you know, on one hand, with no animosity against the Pope is as an individual, this one happens to be a fine person. But Lamaisa, according to many, many views, Catholicism is idolatry. And if it's idolatry, we certainly are not happy to bring more Avodah Zarah, and certainly the representative of idolatry, into Eretz Israel. And not only that, we already have plenty of churches in Jerusalem, but to give him honor and homage and call him His Holiness when he's an Oved Avodah Zarah and the like. But on the other hand, this is a reminder that we live in Golus. And when we live in Golus, we have to have good relationships with powerful non-Jews. And this has happened in the past, the Maral himself, and much later Gedolim, you know, not with the Pope, they talked with cardinals and bishops and very high officials. So it's a type of thing where basically, because we live in Golus, and even in Yerushalayim we're in Golus, and we also have to make Kiddush Hashem and avoid Shulul Hashem, that indeed you have to treat these important Goyim with a great deal of respect, simply because that's the nature of the world we live in. I think there's a certain poetic justice that the Pope comes right before Yom Yerushalayim, although he left before that day. You know, yesterday we had Yom Yerushalayim. I know the Arsameach Minhag is, like almost yeshivas, it was not celebrated in any way. In fact, the old joke, Panovich many years ago used to, they would not, of course, Panovich Rav died before Yom Yerushalayim, before 1967, but it was Yom HaTzmaut was an issue. In Panovich, they did not say Tachanun on Yom HaTzmaut, but they did not say Hallo. So when somebody asked the Panovich Rav, you know, why don't you say Hallo? I thought you were supposed to be a Zionist. The Panovich Rav says, I am a Zionist. I follow Minhag Ben Gurion. What does Ben Gurion do on Yom HaTzmaut? No Hallel, no Tachanun. He says, I do the same thing. Whatever. We say Tachanun. But be it as it may, as you know, Yom Yerushalayim was an important day. It was the day that in 1967 we reacquired the Old City, and more importantly, we reacquired the Temple Mount and the Kaisel, although we never took advantage of that fact, as is evidenced by the situation that we still have. Now, I think it's poetic, though, that the Pope reminds us that even though we conquered Yerushalayim, and even though we have the Har HaBayis, we are very, very far from redemption. We're still in a state of shibud malchios. We're still in a state where we're subordinate to the nations of the world, and we need to placate them, and we need to compliment them, and we need to honor them. So in a way, it kind of creates a greater yearning for the coming of Mashiach. I mentioned in an earlier share, just to bring it out again, that there actually is a big machlokas rishonim. What is the status of Christianity, and in particular Catholicism? Christianity, is you can't really generalize because there are many types of Christianity, but let's say Catholicism. The Rambam Shita, and this is in a censored part of the Mishnah Torah, was that Christianity, because of the Trinity, because of the belief that God has these three aspects, is idolatry, is Avodah Zarah, and not only is it forbidden for a Jew to profess Christian belief, but it's even forbidden for a non-Jew to profess Christian belief, because under the Seven Commandments of Noah, a non-Jew is not permitted to worship Avodah Zarah, and this is Avodah Zarah. As opposed to Islam, although the Rambam was not a lover of Islam, and indeed the Rambam was a victim in his own life of Islamic persecution, and he refers to Muhammad more than once as an insane person, he calls him a Meshuggah. But the Rambam did say the one thing that he can give Islam is, Islam is not an idolatrous religion. It is a monotheistic religion, and Allah is nothing more than the Arabic word for Hashem. I mean, you know, you could say, you know, a Jew can also believe in Allah, but Allah is God. So according to the Rambam, the Pope is clearly an idol worshiper, and you have that problem. But there is another view. And this is the view of Rabbeinu Tam. Now, it's interesting. The Rambam lived in Islamic countries. Rabbeinu Tam lived in France. And Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi's grandson, was, of course, very familiar with Catholicism. That was the religion in France. And Rabbeinu Tam does take the position that although Christianity is a mistaken belief, it's not true, but it's not an idolatrous belief, because ultimately they do believe in the supreme God. There's the Trinity, the Father, the Son, but the Father is superior to the Son. And therefore, there is a sense of ultimate God. So according to Rabbeinu Tam, Christianity would not be idolatry. And I do want to point out that even like the Rambam is only condemning the types of Christianity that are called Trinitarian. But there are Unitarians, there are other types of Christianity that look at Yashka as only Mashiach, not as, as God. And that would not be Avodah Zarah either. That would just be false Mashiach. If a Jew believes in a false Mashiach, that's a violation of the 13 principles of faith, but there's no particular prohibition in the Noahide law of Goyim believing in false messiahs. And so all of this is going to have bearing on how we look at the Pope. But I think in a general perspective, I would look at this as Hashem's reminder that we're still in Golos and we need to seek Rachamim to bring the Geula very soon. This is actually a very hard question. On a simple level, the answer would be hatred towards Rishayim is a good thing. That's a simple answer, but I want to give you a nuance on it. David HaMelech says in Tehillim, those who hate you, Hashem, I hate. And certainly, you know, one should hate Nazis, one should hate Hitler, one should hate Amalek. One hates those who hate God. You hate God, I hate you. And so on a simple level, you can have a lot of sources for that. However, on a deeper level, it's not so pashut. Because Rav Kook writes, and again, Rav Kook was, of course, a great, great lover. Rav Kook writes that even righteous hatred, is a poison that corrupts a person. That when a person loses the capacities of loving anyone, that affects his ability to love Hashem and love Am Yisrael. So Rav Kook emphasized that one should hate the evil and one should not hate the evildoer per se. But as I say, not everybody agrees with Rav Kook, but I think I see in my own observations that people who tend to be haters tend not to be lovers. By that I mean that when you cultivate the virtue of hating evildoers, your love for righteous people tends not to be as strong. Even Rav Kook has a very powerful point that, you know, because once again, when you work, just like a person, let's say, wants to become a weightlifter, right? So he only exercises his right arm. So the right arm becomes real strong, but the left arm doesn't. The more you work on the midah of hate, the less you work on the midah of love. So I would think, therefore, overall, one should try not to be a hater. And I think if you look at most Gedolim, they were not good haters. Even if when they were against many, many things, it was not done in a spirit of hatred. But that's a subtle idea, and many in Eretz Yisrael would not agree with it. That's one of the reasons why Rav Kook was such a controversial person. That way, yeah.
With the Iri Mikloch with the mothers of the Kohanim bringing
food
to prevent the people in the Iri Mikloch from davening the Kohanim die sooner. Is that evidence, or is there an idea that one can daven for bad things to happen and be successful?
Yes, so it's very interesting. There's a machlokas, the Bavli, and the Yushalmi on this very point. The implication of the Mishnah, right, everyone knows this Mishnah, when somebody kills Beshogeg, so they go to the Ir Miklat, and they remain in the Ir Miklat until the Kohen Gadol dies. Now that could be a day, that could be 50 years. Right? You have an indeterminate sentence. You are there until the Kohen Gadol dies. Even if you die first, you're buried in the Ir Miklat until the Kohen Gadol dies, and then your body can be moved to the family plot. So the Mishnah says that because of this, the mothers of Kohanim Gadolim used to send food packages and treats to the people in the Ir Miklat, so the people in the Ir Miklat will not pray that the son will die. It doesn't say they shouldn't get hitmen. It says they should not pray. So the Gemara asks the Kasha, the implication is, if they would pray, the prayer would be effective. But how could a prayer be effective against somebody who doesn't deserve it? Right? So listen to the Bavli and the Yushalmi. Both the Bavli and the Yushalmi ask this question. The answer of the Bavli is that a prayer that something bad should happen to a person who doesn't deserve it is not going to be effective. But the Kohen Gadol has a certain culpability, because as the leader of the generation, he could have prayed that murders not take place. And since he didn't pray enough that murders not take place, he is responsible enough that he could be the victim of the Rotseach's prayer. So in other words, so according to the Bavli, a prayer that something bad happened to a totally righteous person is not going to be effective, but the Kohen Gadol is vulnerable because of his lack of prayer. The Yerushalmi actually says, the power of prayer is so great that even a person who doesn't deserve to be punished can be punished through prayer. Now, you're not allowed to pray that God punish somebody, but theoretically that can happen. Now, I want to point out the following idea. Both the Bavli and the Yerushalmi are telling you how powerful prayer is, but in different ways. The Bavli is saying the Kohen Gadol is vulnerable because he's sinful. But why is he sinful? Because he didn't pray. In other words, his prayer could have stopped the violence. Right? So that's the power of prayer that he didn't use that makes him vulnerable to the murderer's prayer. The Yerushalmi is emphasizing the power of prayer even in a more scary way. Now again, this is the Yerushalmi is very, very frightening, because the Yerushalmi indicates that maybe it's only for Jews, you know, we don't know, but you know, some terrorist is praying that he should be successful in his endeavor. That prayer has a certain power. We might call it dark spiritual energy, right? That's an amazing thing, but that's the power of prayer. Prayer, even of an evil person, prayer even to do an evil thing, is built into the framework of the universe, which is why the only way we can counteract it is with our own prayer. You see, that's exactly the point. The Gemara says a cute thing. The Gemara says that a ganav, before he does his geneva, prays to Hashem that he should be successful. And Hashem might give him a certain success. Now, why that's so is difficult to understand. Why should God answer prayers of unworthy people to do bad things? But we still see that that's the spiritual law of the universe, that prayer has this call. So basically, your particular question is an interesting machlokas, the Bavli and the Yerushalmi.
Well, let's say personality
of the Vilna Gaon. I'm sorry, what
the Vilna Gaon? The personality of the Vilna Gaon.
The personality of the Vilna Gaon. Well, I'm not that old. I wasn't there. Well, I remember Chaim Vilna Gaon. I'll tell you what I envision. What I envision is the Vilna Gaon was like Rebbe Yashiv. I guess it must be much more so. And that is, the Vilna Gaon didn't waste a second. I don't want to trivialize Gedolim, but obviously, Gedolim have personalities too. I mean, Gedolim are Gedolim, but they're personalities. You take someone like Rav Avadya Yosef. Rav Avadya Yosef was also a tremendous maspid. But Rav Avadya Yosef would schmooze, he would joke, you know, he would interact with people. Because he would learn many, many hours a day, but he also took time out. But then you have Gedolim like Rav Yashiv, like literally, you know, if there was like 2 minutes between one thing and another thing, you know, he'd learn those 2 minutes. And not an easy thing like Parsha or Tehillim. I mean, he would go get back into the middle of a hard Taisus or a Rashba or a Ramban just for those 2 minutes. And that was, certainly from every account we have, that was the personality of the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon did not make small talk. He did not schmooze with people. He did not make jokes. Every single second was devoted to Torah. So the Vilna Gaon was obviously a very, 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 very intense personality. The generation needed that. In fact, the whole one could say, in effect, the Vilna Gaon is the founder of the world of the yeshivas. Why is that so? The Vilna Gaon didn't have a yeshiva. The Vilna Gaon had a small group of talmidim. The Vilna Gaon did not have a lot of talmidim either. But one of his talmidim was Reb Chaim Volozhin. Reb Chaim Volozhin started the Volozhin Yeshiva. Volozhin was the mother of Slabodka and Telz and Panovich and Grodna, and all of the yeshivas we have today are from the Vilna Gaon. So in a sense, you could say, to use a scientific analogy, just like the Big Bang, again, I'm not addressing if the Big Bang is accurate or not, but I'm using it just as a mushroom, that that for that initial second, all of the matter of the universe was concentrated in a tiny little thing. And then it exploded and became the universe. It's as if all of the Torah of all of the yeshivas was in one person. And that was the Big Bang that created all of the yeshivas that exist in the world. So because of that, the intensity of the Vilna Gaon was qualitatively different, because he wasn't just a gadol, he was the shorish and the foundation of all of the yeshivas in the world. So like the Big Bang, I think it's a helpful one. Actually, it's the first time I've thought of that, Marshall, but that all of the matter of the Torah world was concentrated in a single person. And there were other great gadols. Vilna Gaon was not the only great gadol of his time. For example, Rebbe Tzvi Baker lived in the life of the Vilna Gaon. And I'll tell you the truth, in terms of the actual learning we do in yeshiva, probably most people learn more of Rabbi Akiva Eger's Torah than the Vilna Gaon's Torah, right? I mean, I could take a survey. How many shiurim spoke out something from the Vilna Gaon in Torah? I mean, most people only know the Chumash things, which are easier. But the Vilna Gaon's Gemara comments are extremely deep and difficult. So the Vilna Gaon's importance in the history of Am Yisrael is not so much for his specific Torah, although that is obviously very, very important. But he was the energy that created, right? So the Vilna Gaon was a very, very intense person. We don't really have a sense of a personality outside of the intensity of the training. So in my own mind, the closest I could imagine was Rebbe Yashuv. Rebbe Yashuv was that way as well. As you say, other Gaonim were not that way.
I've heard of several awful cases of agudas, not just where the husbands go missing, but where the husbands become comatose or insane other awful things.
Yeah.
Can a man get a conditional get upon getting married to a woman that says something like, if I go missing or comatose or insane, for 5 years, then you're divorced, in order to prevent her from becoming an aguda for life? And if so, why don't we do it?
Yeah. That is actually the most tragic case, because most cases of aguna is where either somebody's missing in action, and so then we can fool around with the rules of evidence to match an aguna by circumstantial evidence, whether it's DNA or presumptions of death, etc. Or if you have a husband that's around, we can force him, pressure him. You know, even then, many women are stuck. But the one thing that seems to have no solution is when the husband does not die, but he is incapacitated in a way that halakhically he cannot give a get, because then what can we do? Because remember, a beis din cannot give a get. A beis din needs a husband to give a get, or a shaliach as a husband. So what do you do about this? Now, if the woman, God forbid, is comatose or gets mentally insane, the husband does have the right to get the permission of 100 rabbis to marry another wife. He doesn't divorce his wife, but he can marry another wife, and as long as he takes care of her medical expenses and the like. But when that happens to the man, that is a truly, truly tragic problem for which halacha does not have a solution unless something was done. Now, the question you're raising is this. Can a husband make a shaliach to say that if I become comatose or incapacitated, a get should be given to my wife? The short answer is, it's a machlokas, and that is, it may be possible, but the problem is that according to many opinions, once a husband becomes incapacitated, the appointment of any shaliach he made becomes null and void as well. And it really goes back to, again, I don't want to get into a lungus here, because Saisa Chayshin has an arichas. How do you understand how shalichas works? Does shalichas work by, let's say I'm a husband, right? So I make a shaliach to give a get to my wife. If shalichus is meant to mean, I am giving my authority to you, then that should mean that you now have my authority. So even if I become incapacitated, you have my authority. So that would mean it would work. But the other way of understanding shalichus is that you're an extension of my hand. When you give the get, it's like I gave the get. But if at the time you're giving the get, I don't have the ability to give a get, it's not going to work. So there's a machlokas, the Rambam and the Tur, whether incapacity invalidates shalichus. So it would at least be a machlokas. So we actually paskin the chumrah not to give a get under those circumstances. So that's a, it is a very, very tragic view. But yes, according to some Rishonim, it would be possible. Now, that's very different with the missing in action. Missing in action is a different story. The missing in action, where we assume the husband's alive and we assume he's competent, but he's just imprisoned or something, there, indeed, before he goes off to war or whatever, he could give his wife such a get. But the problem is, that could work for soldiers who know ahead of time. That doesn't really work for random kidnap, unless you give her what you want to get every day, you know, it's not necessarily going to work. Yeah.
I was more curious about if on the day of the wedding,
okay,
gives
okay.
A
so your question is,
if this happens,
right. Okay. So let me explain the problem with that. That's also a solution. Why can't you say? And in fact, some have used that for aguna. Let's say, I hereby. So it's a good way to start a marriage, right? Right after the chuppah, you give your wife a conditional get. Or give a shaliach a conditional get that basically says, in the event we get a civil divorce, in the event I'm missing in action, in the event I'm incapacitated, I hereby make you a shaliach, a beis din, to deliver this get to my wife, right? Now, well, for incapacity, that wouldn't help, for the reason, that still wouldn't help. But the question is, what about aguna and the like? The short answer is, the reason that doesn't work is based on another principle. And this is really from the fourth paragraph of Kitten, and that is, when I write a get for my wife, and then I have cohabitation with my wife, the act of cohabitation is a nullification of the get, and the get cannot be used at that point. So this can work if you give a get or a shaliach before you're kidnapped, so to speak, but you can't do it and then keep on living with her, because the act of living with her would be a nullification of the get. So that's why that doesn't work. Yeah. Yeah.
I heard from a different person that there's a concept that once Mashiach comes, everything we have is tamei enough to get rid of it, but like keep certain things like plastics.
I'm not sure why I have to get rid of it. Things that are tamei, many things can be purified. Metal utensils can be purified by mikvah, and if they need to be sprinkled with the paraduma ashes, they can be sprinkled with paraduma. Now, things like earthenware or china that cannot be purified, they would have to be broken, thrown away, and the like. Food cannot be purified. If food is tamei, that might have to be thrown away. So the issue of plastic would simply be a technical question. Is plastic makabel tuma, or is plastic not makabel tuma? Actually, it is probably the case that because plastic is not wood or metal, it is not mekabel tumah, so I just don't know why you'd have to throw it away. It wouldn't be tumah to begin with. In other words, things are mekabel tumah only if they meet the definitions in the Torah of what is mekabel tumah. Plastic is actually not mekabel tumah, right? So I wouldn't think you'd have to throw it away. Okay? Okay, any... yeah, one more.
I've noticed that some people have a... I don't know if it's a minhag, but some people do a little bit of a bowing procedure during Kedusha or Shemona Esrei. Where does that come from?
At which point are you referring to?
Right before...
You referred to standing up on your toes?
No. Right before Kedusha,
Yeah. There's some people have such a minhag, and that's based on the idea that Kedusha, we are imitating the angels, right? That's what Kedusha is. We are sanctifying your name the way the angels sanctify you in Shemayim, and in Yeshayo, Perek Vav, it is described that the angels sanctify Hashem with Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. In the Navi Yecheskel, they sanctify Hashem with Baruch Tavod Hashem Nimkamo. That's why those are the two critical verses of the Kedusha. In fact, that's why, by the way, Hashem is called, people don't make the connection, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because he is praised by the Pasuk Kadosh, 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 and he is praised by the Pasuk Baruch Kavod Hashem Im Kamo, so he's Kadosh U Baruch, Kadosh Baruch Hu. So since V'kara Zel Zevi Amar is describing the heavens as like a chorus, you have angels here and angels here, and the angels call to each other, it's time to praise Hashem, and you're like acting out the part of the angels, so you say, V'kara zeh el zeh, they call this to the other, as if you're putting yourself on that side of the room, then you're putting yourself on that side of the room. and then you say in unison. So it's a way of acting out the role of the angels, just as rising on your toes is a similar thing, with the mention that the angels rise as they proclaim Kedusha. And of course, the whole idea of our feet together, both for Kedusha and even for Shmon Esrei, is because the angels are described as only having one leg. They don't have two legs, and therefore we want to have one leg when we sanctify Hashem's name. Okay, have a good Shabbos, good Chodesh.